You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a climate psychologist tells us how we can find optimism amid negative climate and environmental news. Now, clinics have stopped providing abortions in Wisconsin after the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling last week that overturned Roe v. Wade. That's because of an 1849 law that theoretically went back into effect after that ruling. That law makes exceptions to save a mother's life, not for rape or for incest. Now the State Department of Justice is filing a lawsuit challenging the enforceability of that law. Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call announced that lawsuit this afternoon. The Attorney General joins us now to talk about the suit. Attorney General Call, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
You're suing to block this 170-year-old abortion ban with an eye on a 1985 law. Can you explain what you're focusing on in this suit?
Sure. So first, since Friday, we've begun to see the impacts already from the decision in Dobbs that overruled Roe versus Wade. Safe and legal abortions have stopped in Wisconsin. Our office has begun getting questions from sexual assault nurse examiners who provide forensic examinations to survivors of sexual assault about what the state of the law is. And women in Wisconsin, if this law is enforced, are going to be less free, less equal, and less safe. So today we announced a lawsuit arguing that the 19th century abortion ban is not in effect in Wisconsin, and that first, it's inconsistent with laws that were passed more recently that regulate abortion but don't prohibit it. And when there are inconsistent laws, there's a lot of court precedent for the idea that the more recently passed laws control. And then we've also argued that the disuse of the abortion ban, which has been understood to be unconstitutional for more than 50 years and was only sporadically used even before then, renders it unenforceable as well.
Now, often when lawmakers rewrite laws, if they do a law in 1985 and there's an existing law in the books, they will specifically cross those old laws out. But that, as I understand it, didn't happen here. Does that put you on shakier ground in trying to challenge that 1849 ban?
You know, there's actually a specific sort of doctrine for these types of cases known as the implied repeal doctrine. Believe it or not, the legislatures, this is not the only time there's been legislation that's in conflict with other legislation on the books. And courts look to certain issues in deciding whether the old statute was repealed. But here, for example, the old ban provides no exception to save the health of the mother, to protect the health of the mother. But newer laws do contain an exception to for abortions that protect the health. It can't be the case that it is both legal and illegal to perform an abortion to protect the health of the mother. And so it's one example of how these statutes are in conflict. And particularly with criminal laws, which this ban is, you know, deferring to the more permissive law is usually the way that it works. You also usually defer to the more recent law. So our argument is the old ban is no longer enforceable.
Now, that more recent ban was passed some years after Roe v. Wade. Could it be argued that, hey, this was conditional? We have this state law. We can't enforce that state law because Roe v. Wade. So here's some empowering legislation giving the federal reality. Well, now that's gone. So that law is no longer relevant.
You know, in a lot of states, there was legislation passed that was known as trigger law legislation that provided that if Roe was overturned, an immediate ban would come into effect. And we're seeing that play out in a number of states right now. But Wisconsin doesn't have a law like that, and we're in a very different position from those states. And so if the legislature wanted to include a provision saying that the old ban comes back into effect, it could have done that. But it didn't do that here. And, you know, there has been a lot of talk about the Supreme Court's decision returning this issue to the states. But what's happening here by those who are arguing for enforcement of the old ban isn't returning this issue to the states. There's no debate going on at the state capitol about this issue. What they're really trying to do is return us to the 19th century by imposing this old law that, you know, was never voted on by anybody in who's currently living in Wisconsin. And if the legislature wants to act, it can do so. But using this old ban, we think is inappropriate.
Talking to Attorney General Josh Call about his legal challenge to an 1849 law regulating abortions, very much limiting abortions in Wisconsin. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said in a statement today, quote, "Once again, we will do Attorney General Call's job and vigorously defend the law. It's sad that Evers and Call want to break the law instead of work with the legislature," end quote. What's your response to the Assembly Speaker's response?
Well, the whole point of this suit is that it's unclear what the law is. The legislature has passed contradictory laws, and we need the courts to clarify what the law is. Now, you know, just a week ago today, the legislature met for a special session that the governor had called so that we could be prepared for the possibility that the Supreme Court would overrule Roe. Governor Evers was right to call that so we could have some clarity in the law, but rather than address the concerns that we knew were coming, the legislature gabbled in and gabbled out. They, for the most part, didn't even show up to address the issue. We need the legislature to act now, because while this litigation is playing out, access to safe and legal abortion in Wisconsin has stopped, and that's impacting people in Wisconsin every day. So the quicker the legislature acts to protect reproductive freedom, the quicker that full equality and freedom and safety for pregnant women in Wisconsin will be restored.
Supposing this ultimately goes to the state Supreme Court and they rule against you and say, in fact, the 1849 law is in effect, what would your approach be then to enforcement?
Well, I've been clear that as long as I'm Attorney General, we're not going to use any resources at the Wisconsin Department of Justice to investigate or prosecute anybody for violations of that old ban. And enforcing that ban would harm the health of women in Wisconsin, and it would do nothing to make our communities safer. We would have to divert resources from the serious kinds of crimes we investigate and prosecute, like homicides and sexual assault and drug trafficking, to abortion cases. And that doesn't serve the interests of Wisconsinites, and we're not going to do it.
As we wrap things up, what is the timeline now for movement on this suit you announced today?
It's always difficult to predict how long a case will take in court, but this is a case that's focused on legal arguments, and there's not likely to be much dispute about the basic underlying facts here. And so that usually helps cases move faster. I would expect that we will hear from the circuit court in a matter of months, probably. It's not going to be immediate by any means, but I don't think it will stretch on for years either. Of course, there are likely to be appeals after that, but how long that process goes is difficult to say.
Attorney General Call, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Call is the Democratic State Attorney General. He talked to us about a lawsuit he announced with Governor Evers this afternoon seeking to block Wisconsin's 1849 abortion ban, which had been superseded by the Roe v. Wade decision. He cited a 1985 law that contradicts that 1849 ban. Roe v. Wade was overruled last Friday by the U.S. Supreme Court. Coming up, we're feeling the impacts of climate change, but a guest says there's still time to change things, and the key science might be psychology. We'll hear the case for spreading climate hope. That's up next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It can be easy to be overwhelmed by news about climate change. Just last month, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said our planet has the most carbon dioxide has ever had since humans walked the Earth. The U.S. wildfire season continues to grow longer and harsher, and other extreme weather events are getting more common. Again, it can be overwhelming to take in, but our next guest says we don't have to give in to despair or to apathy, and one of the most important climate sciences might just be psychology. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you sometimes feel overwhelmed by environmental and climate change news? What do you do to get over that, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Renee Lertzman is a climate psychologist and founder of Project Inside Out. She's author of the book Environmental Melancholia, Psychoanalytic Dimensions of Engagement, that draws in part from research she did in Green Bay. Renee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, I'm very glad to be here with you.
A common response, I think, to climate change, and you've talked about this in TED Talks and elsewhere, can be despair, apathy, denial. What approaches from psychology do you see that can help us work through some of those and take positive action?
Right. Yeah. Well, you named it in your introduction. It's very easy to feel overwhelmed, and it's easy to feel a whole variety of experiences and responses. What I've found over the years is there's actually so much that we can learn and draw from in psychology. So this intersection of kind of where psychology meets climate crisis and environmental issues is just starting to really kind of come together for a lot of people as the anxiety and the kind of the feelings come up more and more. And what I have found to be actually incredibly empowering is recognizing a few things that we now know from psychology. And one of them is that it starts with really honoring and appreciating whatever your experience is. So we want to just start with that baseline of, if I'm feeling overwhelmed, or if I'm feeling angry, or I'm feeling inspired, or I'm feeling motivated, whatever that is, that in itself makes sense. You know, you make sense, it makes sense. These are really big issues. These are complex, they're systemic, and they are going to bring up different feelings for different people in different circumstances and contexts. And so what we know from the psychological research world is that when we turn towards our experience from that place of, yeah, you know, this is what's happening for me, I'm feeling this way, with real acceptance and real understanding, then it's kind of amazing, because then we're actually able to move through it and navigate it much more easily than, say, telling ourselves, oh, what's wrong with me? I shouldn't be feeling this way. I'm weak. I'm a downer. I'm negative. I'm this, I'm that. And we can fall into that sort of self-talk, which actually is not helpful. And it takes us down a path where paradoxically we become almost more mired in that place of sort of a, it's a bit of a spiral.
How do we break out of that kind of self-talk?
Well, we start with being able to acknowledge it, like practicing the ability to notice and pay attention to what it is that we're feeling. And that practice of what Tara Brach, for example, the writer and Buddhist, talks about, radical acceptance, you know, like really coming from that place of turning towards oneself, maybe taking a few moments, you know, doing what you need to do to kind of remind yourself, like, okay, you know, this is what's up for me. But what's also really important is to recognize this isn't an individual problem, that, you know, I work around the world. I work with groups and organizations, you know, all around the globe. And I can tell you that many, many, many people are experiencing very similar things. And we may not be talking about it. We may not be open about it. I found that it's actually a very radical, powerful act to begin to have these conversations with each other and to really just start sharing, you know, this is what's happening for me, or this is what I'm worried about, or what I'm concerned about, what is your experience? And then it helps us really move through that spiral.
That's how to break out of self-talk. Another thing you think a lot about is a situation where person A feels really strongly, is really worried about climate change, and is wondering why everyone around them seems to be so listless and apathetic and uncaring about it. Well, the way I framed it just now, you say, may not be the best way to frame it.
Well, so first, it's very normal and natural to feel that way. So right off the bat, you know, I don't know anyone who, you know, who's paying attention and sensitive and tracking what's happening doesn't have some aspect of that experience of waking up and looking around and basically saying, what the hell, you know, what the heck, like, what is wrong with you? Wake up. We got to do something now. So that's a very normal and natural response to have, but we need to be able to move past that place, because that's actually really counterproductive in terms of our, if we want to actually be effective. And so, so a couple of things. One is, you know, the body of work that I've been working, you know, developing over a couple of decades, it actually started when I was doing my field work in Green Bay, Wisconsin. So it's meaningful for me to be on this show and to be talking with folks in Wisconsin. And what I was doing was spending time in Green Bay having conversations with all kinds of people about the environment, about climate, and about the water, about the Great Lakes, and about the Fox River and the Green Bay. And what I found in having these conversations and really listening to people closely is that I couldn't really, I didn't meet a single person who literally didn't care, right? So what I found is that what's happening more often is that people are going through a lot of very complicated responses to what is happening, and have ways of coping with that and have ways of dealing with that. And that may look like not caring. It may look like what we would call apathy or tuning out or even outright hostility. That actually these are really big issues that for a lot of people are really hard to process. And so this idea of the myth of apathy kind of took hold when I was spending time in Green Bay, which has really carried through a lot of what I've been doing over the past several years. And going back to your prompt about that tendency to want to kind of turn towards people and shake them and just feel really frustrated, and that's not always productive. The way I talk about that now is that we have a tendency to feel like we have to either educate, give people more information, or we feel like we have to be cheerleaders and try to be really positive and upbeat. Or we might feel like we have to be writing, R-I-G-H-T, which is the moralizing, preaching, like this is why this is the right thing to do, and sort of, you know, come at people that way. When in actuality, going back to psychology, and especially the field of motivational interviewing in the public health sector, is that we are generally more open and responsive when we're feeling listened to, and when we feel that there's partnership and guiding. And so I spend a lot of my time talking about guiding. What does it mean to be a guide, you know, who cares deeply about what's happening with the climate, with the planet, and being more thoughtful about the tendency to write, educate, or cheerlead, which is what you were describing there. And it's actually really hard to do. It's a practice. It takes time. But the first step is actually the self-awareness to be able to reflect and consider, oh, okay, well, what is my tendency and how are people experiencing me? And then the other part of that is how do I manage my own emotional reaction so that I can show up in a way that's you know, maybe more of a guide and less of a educator, cheerleader, or writer.
Talking to Renee Lertzman, a climate psychologist, founder of Project Inside Out, talking about how to talk about complicated issues like climate change. Renee, can you talk some more about how to open that kind of conversation? It's not me and you arguing or yelling at each other or one-upping one another with our virtue. How do we have that kind of honest and, I guess, empathetic conversation?
Exactly. So I take my cue from what I've learned, especially in motivational interviewing, which is the practice of coming at these conversations from a place of inquiry, of compassion, and a seeking to understand, which is actually really hard when the stakes are high and we're maybe triggered or we have very strong feelings. It's very hard to do that, but it's absolutely possible to do that, especially with, again, self-awareness and practice. But when I'm approaching interactions, conversations with people who might be in very different places around this, I start with asking first, what is your experience? Like, what are you noticing? What are you thinking about? Where are you at with this? Right. So I don't lead with, you know, this is what I care about. What do you think? Do you agree with me or not? I start with, hey, I'm really curious, like, where are you at with this? What's your experience been? And so that's number one, is coming from that place of curiosity, seeking to understand what people may already know and not know. And then the next part of that is reflecting back what you hear being said. So reflective listening, to basically say, so you this, that, you know, reflecting without correcting, educating, you know, kind of trying to change the person. You're just reflecting back. And it's amazing, if you take just a few minutes of doing this, it really helps establish some trust and just a sense of, you know, people can kind of relax a little bit more. It's like, okay, this is safe. I'm not going to be attacked. I'm not going to be shamed. This person is going to tell me what's wrong with me. You know, it's really okay for me to be where I am with this. So that's the second part. The third really important part is to ask for some kind of permission before offering your perspective or more information. So for example, I would say, you know, I would ask some open-ended questions. What's your experience? What have you noticed? Where are you at with this? What troubles you? What doesn't? And then I would reflect back what I heard. And then I would basically say, would you be open to hearing where I'm at with this? Or would you be open, or is it okay if I tell you some things I've learned recently that have really gotten my attention? It's just a way of kind of asking permission. And that's another thing that's really key in motivational interviewing, is ask for permission before you offer. And so then the person can either say yes or no. And usually people will say yes, because we see ourselves as generally open people, open-minded. And so that in itself is really powerful, because I'm hearing myself basically say, yes, I'm open, even if I might be feeling kind of mixed about it. And then it gives, you know, me, a climate concerned person, that ability to go into this territory and then to check in and say, so where are you at? How is this landing with what I'm saying? So it's an actual conversation. You're not trying to pitch, persuade, motivate, change anyone. You're really seeking to have a conversation. And paradoxically, that is what shifts people most, is having a really good, substantial, respectful conversation.
And we'll leave it there. Renee, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Renee Lertzman, climate psychologist, founder of Project Inside Out, also author of Environmental Melancholia, inspired in part, as you heard, by her work in Green Bay. Tomorrow on Central Time, more on recent Supreme Court rulings, this time guns. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a pain specialist explains the hows and whys of migraine disorders, which affect a lot of Americans, women in particular. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, U.S. Supreme Court made a pair of rulings on religion and public schools over the last week. We examine the current state of the separation of church and state. First, it's National Migraine and Headache Awareness Month. Migraine is a very common disorder. It affects an estimated 12% of Americans, with women about three times as likely to be affected as men. That's according to the Cleveland Clinic. When you think of a migraine, you might think of a visual aura followed by a debilitating headache. That's what migraine looks like for some people, but it's not always the case. Symptoms can vary a lot from person to person, and from migraine to migraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you get migraines? When did you start getting them? What have you learned about them, and maybe what seems to trigger them in your life? Do you have questions for our guest about migraines, what they are, how they're treated? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Ala Abed El Sayed, or Dr. Al, is the medical director of UW Health Pain Services and medical director of the UW Pain Clinic, where he performs migraine pain interventions. Dr. Al, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I have in my head, I probably like a lot of people, this conception that, you know, you get the visuals of a migraine, then you get the big headache of the migraine. But like I just said, it doesn't always work that way. Can you talk about the range of things people might experience with a migraine?
Yeah, and thank you for bringing this point, because it's a very important point. Sometimes we learn about classic picture of migraine coming with aura and all those symptoms. But actually, most of the time in my practice, I'll see a patient without an aura. That's why I recommend that anyone who's having headaches that are of nature concerning, they need to be checked, because it could be migraine. It doesn't have to be accompanied by the aura.
Yeah, for people like I, you know, I sometimes get headaches. I think pretty much everybody gets a headache now and then. I'm pretty sure I've never had a migraine, but I guess I don't know for sure. When do I say, hey, maybe this is more than just your run-of-the-mill headache and get, I don't know, evaluated for migraines?
So there are very well kind of published diagnostic criteria. I'll go through it like in 1 minute here.
Sure.
But if patients have like five attacks, you know, with headaches lasting 4 to 72 hours, which can be like unilateral in nature, pulsating quality, moderate to severe pain, causing impairment of routine physical activity, associated with nausea, vomiting, you know, sensitivity to light. All of these are criteria that can warn the patient that this could be a migraine headache.
And you said unilateral, meaning on one side of the face or one side of the head?
And this is a typical picture. There are, you know, sometimes I'll see bilateral, I'll say much less frequent. But typically in the diagnostic criteria, if it's taking one side of the head, unilateral.
Now, suppose somebody is diagnosed with migraines. Is there much we can do about them? Do we have effective treatments that are going to help a lot of people?
There are treatments. And the first thing in treatment is to trying to identify triggers. So usually we'll ask patients if what triggers your headache. Sometimes it can be eating chocolate, alcohol, drinking alcohol, you know, stressors, sleep change, certain physical factors. And we try to eliminate those triggers first. And then we try to educate the patient on meditation, you know, some behavioral changes. If that doesn't get us all the way to control the headaches, then we start talking about the two classes of medications, either medications to treat the headache as they occur, and there are medications that prevent them from happening. So if the headache can happen, people can use over-the-counter medication, what's called the triptans, DHE. These are medications to abort the headaches when they happen. Preventive medication, things like using you know, blood pressure medication, antidepressants, anti-seizure medications, which are taken on a regular basis to reduce kind of the occurrence of migraines. So there are good treatments. Mm. And then we have the interventional treatment as well. If medication treatments are not, I'd say, providing satisfactory control, then we use interventions.
Now, before we get into some of those interventions, I should ask, I'm curious, you know, if you could put it in terms that even I can understand, what's going on in our head when we get a migraine? Physically, what is causing it?
Another good question, and I'll keep it very simple.
Thank you.
Basically, triggers or something will cause, I'd say, stimulation of brain cells. This increases some chemical mediators in the body. That's why we talk about the aura prodroma, prodrome and many other symptoms, because there is increasing chemical transmitters that basically, you know, can cause many body symptoms. In turn, those chemical mediators can cause vasoconstriction, which causes the headaches. Similar effect happen with estrogen. That's why we find it more common in women because they have more estrogen. So that's all why, you know, it's more of a systemic, I would say, condition more than a headache in itself.
We're talking about migraines with Dr. Alaa Abdel-Sayed, a.k.a. Dr. Al from UW Health and the UW Pain Clinic. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you'd like to share your experiences with migraines. Were you able to find something that seemed to trigger them? Did it help to avoid it? Is there something that has worked for you? Do you have a question about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jade joins us now in Manitouish Waters. Jade, hi.
Hi there. How are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Jade?
I identify with a lot of what he was saying. My mother started having migraines when I was 5. I'm 27 now, and it started with auras on some days, then most days, then pain was introduced, and now it's been about 10 years where it's just been nonstop pain for her. And she, like you said, Botox worked for a while. She had some surgery. She had the hysterectomy to help with the estrogen. You know, they've just done everything, and she just can't find any relief, you know, and it's about pain management at this point for her. And I was wondering how, you know, if you have anything that maybe I haven't really heard before, you know, for management or treatments.
Jade, I'm so sorry for your mom. Best to her, and thanks for sharing her story. Dr. Al, of course, you can't diagnose her over the phone, but for people who, you know, all the treatments might help a little, like Jade was saying, but ultimately it gets worse and worse. What are some of the things that we have now or maybe on the horizon that can help in those cases?
Yeah, I would like to thank you, Jade, for calling and making this comment. And sorry to hear about your mom and all what she's gone through. And I think that the thing I want to shed some light on here. You can see how dramatic it can go. People can go for surgeries. Migraine can be a life destroying condition. But before all of this, there are new interventions we do at UW to help with migraines. One of the procedures I described in 2015, which I named it the ablation technique, where we do the nerve blocks and what's called radio frequency ablation, trying to ablate the nerves that can sensitize it when they trigger migraine. So this way we avoid the triggers. Then we use infusion therapies and other things, trying to get people, and we use implantable devices. So try to basically control the migraine so patients do not have to go down the route of having very aggressive surgeries or major surgeries for the treatment of migraine.
Jade, thanks so much for calling. Best again to your mom. We'll go now to Rebecca in Newton. Rebecca, hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a migraine sufferer for probably the last 25 years, I would say. I had a few of the migraine episodes when I was younger in my 20s with the aura and the flashing lights. But since I had children in my early 30s, I get a migraine probably every time I have my monthly cycle, and I'll get a 2 or 3 or 4, sometimes 5 day migraine. I do have medication I take for it, but now I'm entering perimenopause, and I've noticed that they've gotten way worse than they used to be. I'm getting them sometimes 2-3 times a month, and I'm wondering if that's that estrogen connection that you talked about, and is it low estrogen causing them, too much estrogen causing them? I just noticed it's always around the time of my cycle. So I'm just curious about that.
Rebecca, thanks for the call. Dr. Al?
Yeah, thank you, Rebecca. Actually, what you mentioned is very classic because it's migraines can be associated with increased estrogen. That's why they can happen around the menstrual cycle every month for women. So pretty typical, and I think, many patients will come explaining that it happens around the menstrual cycle. So again, very standard, and we recommend the patients use like abortive medications around that time to get some control.
Rebecca, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We are talking about migraines with Dr. Al for the UW Pain Clinic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been able to find relief for your migraines? What has worked for you? What hasn't? How have migraines impacted your daily life, your family, your work to do the things you want to do? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about migraines, which affect about 47 million Americans, 75% of them women. Our guest is Dr. Al, Medical Director of UW Health Pain Services, Medical Director of the UW Pain Clinic. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have an experience to share, maybe something that worked for you, or a question for our guest. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Heath is with us now in Oregon. Heath, hi.
Yes, I was curious that, like, I suffer from cluster headaches and wondering what the treatments for cluster headaches and migraines are similar. And if, is there, because I'm just basically to oxygen and giving myself a shot in the leg for my cluster headaches. Is that in comparison with a lot of migraines?
He thanks for the question. Sorry to hear that. I understand cluster headaches are not a good time at all. Dr. Al, is there a relationship, or you want to compare and contrast cluster headaches versus migraine?
Yeah, so these are two different kinds of headache, and I'm glad actually cluster headaches happen more in men than women. So that's a great example here. And the treatment, I would say, as we mentioned here, our patient mentioned like taking oxygen. That's actually a good measure. Some of the medications can work for both. But I highly recommend to be checked, because there are things based on physical exam and history we can do more in means of medications and interventions to help the cluster headache.
Heath, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Brandon joins us now in Onalaska. Hi, Brandon.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
So I used to suffer from migraines, and 8 years ago I had a stroke that was classified as RCVS, or reversible cerebrovascular syndrome, and it was just a constriction of the blood vessels in my brain. And ever since then, I actually have not had a migraine. So I'm just curious if you've ever heard about that, like other people who have had migraines and then possibly had a stroke or even like a brain injury and then just never had migraines after that.
Wow. Brandon, well, I'm sorry to hear about the stroke, but I guess I'm glad you had the silver lining of no migraines. What do you make of that, Dr. Al?
So I have seen this before. I wouldn't say it's common, but as we spoke earlier about the mechanism of action, a lot of it has to do with, release of chemical mediators, vasoconstriction. Having some vascular event might actually, reverse that process or cause opposite process. That's why migraines do not get triggered the same way, reduce the excitability of the cells. So there is some science behind this, and it can happen.
Interesting. Brandon, thanks for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. Now, you, Dr. Al, specialize in headaches and migraines. Doesn't sound like there are a ton of specialists out there. Do we have the expertise out there that people can access and get diagnosis and treatment from?
You make a very good point with talking about the shortage now and everything. Before even the pandemic, we had shortage in pain. And not in pain and headache medicine, basically, providers. But I would say it's practiced by neurology and pain management. So I'll give an example here at UW. We have a very robust headache group in neurology who start working with the medication management. And then when it comes to the interventional part, then we do it here at the pain clinics. We have a very comprehensive setting here at UW. But you're right. Yeah, it's not common to find people who care for headache patients. But I guess we're lucky in Wisconsin.
Now, for people who have occasional migraines, they're not a super regular part of their lives. They may not need some of the more serious interventions. Are there, over-the-counter or self-treatments that can help people with that, with that occasional migraine problem?
Yes. There are the abortive medication that people can use, over-the-counter medication like NSAIDs, Tylenol, and all those medication. And if these control the pain, I think that's sufficient. And I would highly recommend for those patients to get established, not necessarily get any treatments, but get established at the headache clinic or the pain clinic. Make sure people know you, and make sure, sometimes headache can be a sign of something else going on. That's why maybe some workup will be needed to make sure there's no brain tumor, for example, because headache is not only migraine. There are many other reasons. So more get it cleared, checked, established in a system. Because if at any point the over-the-counter medications are not working, there are other medications that can be used also for aborting the headaches. So I would say I want to make sure the patient is well taken care of by the professionals.
We are talking to Dr. Ala Abed El-Sayed, a.k.a. Dr. Al, Medical Director of UW Health Pain Services, Medical Director of the UW Pain Clinic, looking at migraines. It's National Migraine and Headache Awareness Month. Still time for your calls with your experiences, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Elizabeth is with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's your story, Elizabeth?
Well, I'm 64 now, but I suffered from migraines for about, 10, 20 years. It's just a blur, so I don't remember how many years. But I took a prescription called Axert, A-X-E-R-T, and it was really great for migraines. But the best part of what I'm going to tell you is, unfortunately, I had a stroke 5 years ago. And it was one that I fully recovered from. But when I was in the hospital, when I went to the ER, they gave me TPA injection. And it's something that goes through your blood vessels and breaks up all the blood clots, I guess. And ever since I had TPA in that stroke, I've never had a headache, not even a headache or a migraine.
Wow. Okay, Elizabeth, thanks a lot for that call. Dr. L, obviously we don't want to have a stroke be our cure for our migraines, but is there something we can learn from that, though, that can help us treat migraines, you know, without going through the stroke?
You know, exactly the same observation that, you know, unfortunately, getting stroke is not great, but might help the headaches again. You know, it's kind of the whole idea here is you're trying to control the kind of the vascular tone in the brain. Obviously, by strokes, you know, that can reverse the process of migraine so they don't trigger again because you don't get the vasoconstriction anymore. So I would say, yeah, I mean, it's probably one good thing about having a stroke, but all strokes overall are not desired.
Elizabeth, thanks again for that call. Dr. Al, you talked about that ablation treatment you pioneered some years back as something that's working for people. What else are you looking at on the horizon when it comes to research or potential treatments, maybe especially for the people who just haven't found relief from the existing options?
You know, that's another excellent question. So every time I see a patient where we don't have something at the moment to treat them, I always ask them to check back in a year. Because there is a lot of evolution happening in the management of migraine, both in medications and interventions and implantable devices. So I'm aware of now of many actually devices that will be implanted for treating migraine as well as new medications. So I highly recommend any patient out there who could not find relief for the pain for years, please keep it checking every year. There is a lot coming every year that can help managing your migraines. You don't have to be sitting up with this disabling condition, but rather get the appropriate pain relief.
So you mentioned implantable devices. Are these things going in our brains, or are they just things that release hormones? What are we talking about?
Yeah,
here?
There are implantable devices actually one of them just got the approval where you can put it actually on the outside of the head, and it does help with migraine headaches. And we have used them at UW. And then there are medications coming to work with different mechanisms of action. And there are implantable devices which will deliver medications. You put them high up in the neck. And again, the evolution keep happening. Every year we're finding more treatments for pain and migraines.
And I want to bring things around to where I started here. Where is the line between, I get headaches sometimes like people do, and, hey, I should go get this checked out with a doctor? Can you give some encouragement for who should maybe be seeking out medical help and looking a little more deeply into those headaches?
Sure. First of all, there are warning signs. If the headache is coming with warning symptoms or signs, for example, like, you know, loss of control, loss of urine control, worst headache ever, impairment in vision. So I would say something concerning. Or happening too frequent, then definitely need to be checked. Not necessarily to get treatment or diagnose migraine, but more to clear that there is nothing serious going on. Again, people need to remember that that's how people find about brain tumors, about how hemorrhage, if that they will get headache, that will be the first thing that will happen. So we want to make sure there is nothing dangerous going on. Then if the patient, again, happy after clearance with some over-the-counter medications, completely fine, but if it gets more frequent or getting worse or more severe, then they need to be revisit their physician to make sure they get appropriate treatment and control. One important piece of information I'd like to mention, the longer the pain and migraines go uncontrolled, the harder to treat. It's better to control it as they happen.
Well, that's a good message. Just very briefly, that's when to seek medical treatment. Are there headache symptoms that should take us to an emergency room for urgent treatment?
Yes. Again, whenever you have warning signs, symptoms or signs, like I mentioned, this is definitely something that need to go immediately to be checked because it could be, you know, a symptom of some dangerous condition.
Dr. Al, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Ala Abed El-Sayed, Medical Director of the UW Health Pain Services and Medical Director of the UW Pain Clinic, where he performs migraine pain interventions. He joined us today for a look at migraines, some of their causes, their symptoms, and their treatments. Hey, if you have found something that works for you, if you have a happy ending story for a migraine condition, something that helps prevent them or treat them, let us know about it. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, a legal studies professor joins us to look at the separation of church and state. That's in the wake of two recent Supreme Court rulings just over the last week related to religion and public schools. One, when state governments might have to provide funding to religious schools. Another, on prayer on school grounds at public schools. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.